Our guest today, Felicity Barringer, has been a national environmental correspondent at the New York Times since November 2003. She joined the Times as a contributing correspondent in Moscow in 1986, reporting on the political and cultural upheavals of the Gorbachev and Glasnost era. And since then, she's covered demographics and social policy in the Washington Bureau. She was a deputy editor of the Week in Review section. She covered business. She's also written for the Columbia Journalism Review, Art News, the Times Book Review, the magazine, and is author of a book, Flight from Sorrow, a biographical study of a survivor of Nazi Germany in the camps of Stalin's Soviet Union. Before coming to the Times, Felicity was a reporter for the Washington Post for many years, and is also a another great example of where being a campus journalist can lead to. She was the editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily. She graduated from Stanford in 1972. And please join me in welcoming Felicity. So did you always know you wanted to be a journalist and you were going to be a journalist from when you were in college? And then
I always knew I wanted to write, and I had notions in high school of being a fiction writer. And I remember turning in a story in one particular class, and the story was read out loud. And it's kind of a fable, and it had dwarves in it, and everybody laughed at the names I gave the dwarves. So I figured I wasn't very good at creating character. Really couldn't do dialogue at all. Story arc? Well, if you can't do all of that on your own, the nice thing about journalism is it's all there. You just have to find it. You find your characters, you find your quotes, you find your dialogue, you find your story arc, and it has the benefit of being real. So if I wanted to write journalism, it would like the right way to go.
And did you find that at the Daily?
Oh, yeah, I found that at the Daily. It was a very different time for student newspapers. The campus was in complete anti-Vietnam War upheaval. You know, we'd have protests coming into the Daily office and saying, "You will publish this story." Remember one in particular, somebody had written an op-ed opinion piece, and we had very small papers then. They got bigger for a long while, now they're small again. But it was an op-ed piece that would have taken up the entire editorial page. And we said, no, we'll take your piece, we're interested in the ideas, but it's got to come down by half. And so all of a sudden, protesters and the numbers of, in the high, double digits, 60, 70, 80 protesters, were in there saying, "You will do this." And I was saying, "We will continue to have our editorial control. We will control what happens with this story. We will cut it to the length we need it to." Meanwhile, the editorial page editor, who was a freshman and very sympathetic to the cause, was throwing all the ads off the editorial page to make more room for this. So finally, in the end, I think I cut three sentences as a symbolic statement of my editorial control, and one of them got up on our news desk and announced victory, and they all left. So it was a different time. It was an exciting time to be a college editor. It stood me in very good stead, because one thing that happens often in newspapers, particularly if you go to larger newspapers, is you're not in the grocery store with the person who's mad at your story. You know, they're not on the other side of the synagogue or down the church pew or wherever. You're not seeing them when you're out jogging in kind of adult life. Well, on campus, you sure are. And it is to have to confront the people who don't like your coverage over breakfast, you know, when you both got assignments to finish for some damn writing class or something. It hones your sensibility about what you're about as a journalist and hones your sort of self-definition that you can both be independent and do what you want to do, but you also see close up the impact of what you're doing. And it's really easy to forget the the impact you have as you, you know, as you're further away from it. And yeah, that's one of the reasons I always say get out of the office. Because as much as you can. Because yeah, it's practical, it's not, it's inexpensive. You sit there on a phone, you get an article that's essentially 85-90% of what it would be if you'd been out and gotten the dateline, but your next 10 articles are going to be poor for not having heard the things you would have heard when you left the office. So
the first assignment I asked the students to do was, you know, to pair up and write a short profile of each other. So to, you know, to, and my reason and my argument for doing that was that it's good experience to be on both sides of that. And to also that, it just, so just listening to what you were saying, and also, you know, I said that compassion is part of the job. I mean, part of...
I'd say empathy more than compassion. All right. It's a fine distinction.
Okay, but to talk a little bit about that. I mean, even if you disagree very strongly with somebody, which I know you do when you're out reporting, you know.
Well, I mean, for me, the framing of a story comes from who you are, what your opinions are, all the strength of those opinions. And just what John was saying earlier, if you're not willing when you go out to throw that frame over for a better frame from what you're learning, you're not going to do good journalism. And if you're going out and kind of looking at people through the frame entirely, which means looking at people in caricature, it's not good for your reporting. I mean, there's a difference between that and saying we can all sing kumbaya with resources. It's not that kind of thing. It's saying, okay, where does this person's point of view on this issue come from? What is it about their life experience? What is it about who they listen to and who they talk to? It's, I used to bristle when I was reporting in Moscow at American groups that would come over, and I was, you know, I was of a more liberal persuasion when I went to Moscow. It wasn't as if I was a huge anti-communist. But people would come over and say, well, they all love their children, so they're just like us. And I'm going, yes, but no. You know, there are some very fundamental differences. So empathy to me is not, it's a bit recognizing the, you know, commonality of human behavior, but that's the, or commonality of the human spirit, but that's the very lowest level. More to the point is everybody's ideas and political beliefs and actions come from somewhere. And whatever you think about the actions, and however you think they are not justified because the person loves their kids or has some common human bond with you, it's your responsibility to figure out how they got there, what the thought process was, what the influence was. Because if you don't convey that as a journalist, again, you are reproducing caricatures, and more, as all of you have heard of this age, you're reproducing caricatures for people who agree with you to begin with. So part of the empathy thing is open-mindedness, being willing to listen to somebody who comes at something entirely different, and really listen. Not just sort of take notes and say, I can't believe he's saying this, but boy, will it look good when I put it out there and he's going to look really silly having said it. Or the people who agree with me will say, how could he possibly have said that? It's that, I think, is where open-mindedness, intellectual honesty, empathy, and a resistance to caricature is really important.
So I often think of this as taking a kind of anthropological approach. I mean, you know, that, I mean, or in a sense, you know, that people are curious. People are curious animals.
Yes.
How do they, and to try to understand, you know, how did this person get that way? I mean, why did they think that way? What led them to say this and try to really understand that?
I mean, I would say, and this is not giving away too much in advance of publication, but so don't put this up on the podcast until the story runs if you can. But I've just come from Montana, where I was doing an interview and a kind of community profile in one of the most, I'd say, in the broad definition of the word, one of the most environmentally and ecologically sensitive places I've been. These are people who live near nature, work in nature in some cases. Certainly, recreation is all about getting out into the woods. And the one thing that binds them, other than the woods and the wildlife around them, that binds them most closely is they all own guns and they all like to shoot. And it's not, by and large, it's not assault rifles, although there's some of those. But they grew up with guns. Their parents, usually dads and sons, I did not interview a lot of women, like, you know, maybe 2%, 10% of the people I interviewed. But they think very differently than I think about weapons. So while some of the interviewing was around gun control and Newtown and those other issues, I'm looking at people who, on, you know, a scale of being close to nature and, you know, in one set of parameters, look very similar to people who would call themselves environmentalists. These people would never call themselves environmentalists, but the values were there. Using nature and relating to nature as a way of relating to the world. Now, the way they relate to it mostly is about killing animals. But unless you're a vegetarian, and I assume some of you are, but for those of you who are not vegetarian, I'm not a vegetarian. I cannot see any moral superiority between eating an In-N-Out and a guy going and taking a deer and putting the venison in his freezer for his family. To me, I haven't. That's not a problem for me. That's, you know, the big things from the head that go on the walls, that's a little different. But that's, you know, that's a separate issue. It was important for me I've been to Kalispell before. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous place. But it was important for me to put the two things together, the gun sensibility and what you would call a sensibility about nature. Albeit they don't relate to it, like probably most of you do. Yes?
I have a question.
Sure, say your name. Introduce
Ciara
yourself.
Martin. I agree that it's really important to keep an open mind and sort of hear where someone is coming from before you necessarily make judgments, especially for the sense of a journalist,
yeah,
and storytelling. How do you maintain that if the person you're interacting with doesn't necessarily do the same thing for you?
It's hostile?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess as a journalist, you can sort of say that you're trying to be objective, but do you ever encounter that? Or
on this story,
really,
I mean, it's
hostile and attacking, and you're trying to be open-minded, and you're not getting
it. Well, it wasn't hostile and attacking. It was three-quarters of what you're talking about, not the full panoply of, you know, you stupid reporter, you don't know nothing, and whatever, no. I was with a video journalist, and what he wanted, we got a lot of good things for our respective media, and he wanted to see somebody firing a gun, and we didn't have that. And so we went to a shooting range, and we were recommended to this range by the police chief. So I got to call up and say, hi, I'm from the New York Times, I'm coming. The police chief just said we could come and talk to you and some of your customers, or that he suggested that it might be a good idea if we wanted to find people shooting to go to you. Turned out it was a father and son that owned this place, and it's pretty clear to me I talked to the son. And the son said, sure, come over. That's fine. We pull into the parking lot. It's about a 10-mile drive from downtown Kalispell. We pull into the parking lot. There are about 10 other vehicles there. Every single one is a pickup truck. My colleague said to me as we drove up in our little rented Toyota, he said, one of these things is not like the others. We went in. I went and talked to the son, and he was perfectly polite. I waited for a couple of people who were getting ready to shoot to go through their, the paperwork, whatever. He was perfectly polite. He said, you got to have to talk to him over there, and there was an older gentleman. And he was having none of this. Everybody else in this place where you would think the New York Times name would not be welcomed had been extremely open with us, pretty open. We are strangers after all. We are from places that are not Kalispell. This guy just, no, we are not going to do any interviews. Well, actually, what we really wanted was film of people. people shooting. We don't know how you're going to use it, and we're not going to give any interviews. And I said, well, Eric will tell you how we're going to use it. And he said, let's cut this short. We're not going to see you. You can leave. And then one of the guys who did, you know, a sort of Vietnam vet in a woodsman's shirt and long blonde hair pulled back, hands me a piece of paper saying, and, you know, if you're from the New York Times, this is what we're worrying about. It was some download off the internet about communist takeover was about to happen. Well, okay, they weren't yelling at me, but what did we do? We left. You know, what are you going to do? We left, we started looking for other shooting ranges. We went to one that was still on the map, but it wasn't there when you got to that place on the map. And then we went to another that was a skeet shooting place, and it was beautiful. All the skeet traps were up, colder than hell, and nobody was there. So if Eric is still working on getting film of one of these guns being shot in Kalispell, preferably. But that's what you do is you let them blow off. Say you respectfully disagree if they really get offended. If they get personally offensive, you don't have to take that just because you're a journalist. Personally offensive as to, you know, your honesty, your integrity, your ethics. I'm sorry, read my stuff. It's not fair of you to say that, and you can't make assumptions about me like that. You don't have any obligation to be personally abused in that circumstance. But if it's a kind of political tirade, it's part of your report.
Sorry, can I ask one more question building on that? Have you ever experienced anything being a woman journalist, like traveling to foreign countries, or can you speak to that?
Yeah, I've been reasonably lucky. The hardest thing as a woman journalist was when I was UN bureau chief, getting ambassadors from Muslim countries to let me pay for lunch. That didn't happen. Could not happen. By and large, I have not worked in some of the countries where that would... I really did virtually no work in Muslim countries. In Muslim areas of the Soviet Union, I did a little work. And I did... The places where I've worked, where women were not appreciated and were looked down on or were going to be dismissed without any real interaction, I can count on the fingers of one hand. And I will try to remember instances. I know there were one or two, but I think they were in this country, and I can't remember them.
So, I mean, you've covered these really amazing, important world events, the changes in the Soviet Union, then, you know, I mean, even, you know, these things like, you know, these issues around guns, many others, you know, business,
yeah.
You know, Wall Street.
Well, media. I didn't do Wall Street. I did media business.
Media. Now you've been on the environment beat, the national correspondent, on the environment for the New York Times for 10 years.
Eight, but who's counting?
Okay.
How does it's more than eight. You're right.
Yeah, about 10.
Yeah,
it's almost
getting,
10. You're
getting
about 10 years now. So how does that, I mean, how does that compare, you know, to the sort of level of, just so you know, to the level of excitement, importance, you know, of some of these other things that you've
Well, it's interesting that you say importance, because that's something that for journalists, there's often a time horizon to importance. So guns are really important right now because we're still within the time bubble of Newtown and the other shootings, and there's a kind of accretion of emotion and interest and importance around that. But it'd be hard to argue that there's much more important in terms of coverage than issues like climate change, but the time horizon changes the internal feel of importance. So if you're covering a UN resolution in the wake of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the question is whether any of the rest of the world, aside from Britain and Spain and Palau, are going to go along with the United States, that seems of intense importance, and it's compressed into this time frame immediately after the invasion, and, you know, while there's still an effort on the part of the American government to an increasingly futile effort to make it seem that this is a broad-based cause of major countries around the world. That seems incredibly important, and that gets on the front page, and you have to, you know, have a lot of sources and do things really fast. But that made a political difference, or didn't in this case make a political difference, in the way the U.S. government could cast its role and could frame its actions for a few months in 2003, not even for history. Environment coverage is much more difficult for two reasons. One, environment is a not always useful and very diffuse term. I, for a while, was playing with a riff about the sort of nine nations of the environment. You know, there's the country of mining, the country of oceans, you know, the country of well, I guess extractive industries, not just mining, although you could pull mining off as a separate republic within the country of extractive industries. Chemical, you know, agricultural chemicals, pesticides. These all have huge individual histories as businesses, as chemistry, as biology, and that's a lot to learn. They all come under this heading, environment. They have business histories. They have, as I said, you know, chemical, biochemical, biological histories. They have political histories. They have economic histories that go with them. And you have to kind of try to get your arms around all of that to be able to do it right. All I said was I thought when I took the beat, I've learned Russian, I've covered the Soviet Union, I can do this, no problem. And the first 2 years of the learning curve of covering the environment had me completely gobsmacked. It was much harder than learning Russian. I mean, learning Russian was a discrete activity that, you know, you had ways to work on and you were there and you could reinforce what you were learning and all of that was good. Every single story of the first dozen stories I did was like a graduate seminar in that subject, in logging, in ocean, in biodiversity, in ocean management, in biodiversity, in collapse of fish stocks, in, you know, how you classify a particular fish as, you know, one of the things the Bush administration did was try to classify farmed salmon as part of the, you could count farmed salmon as the same as wild salmon if you were looking at whether or not a particular run of salmon was endangered. You know, you have to learn a lot about how fish are put together. So it was hard. And I've got to remember the second thing is the time horizon. It's hard to do. It's complicated to explain, and it's never urgent in the sense that other news is urgent. It may be overwhelmingly important, but it's not urgent. And that is, you have to figure out ways to get around that and make it feel urgent. There is an urgency to the environment, but the biggest challenge is creating that sense of urgency in your stories without kind of that ridiculous hype and behaving like a guy with sandwich board on his saying the world is ending tomorrow.
So is that why it's remained compelling and interesting to you for so long? Has it?
Yes. A, it has, because you get to, as you get finer grained knowledge, you suddenly realize, well, this story is the best story to do in that arena. Or you think, I haven't visited pesticides in a while, and I need to go there. But it would not be... What was compelling in the beginning was just learning enough to be able to do your own well-researched take and not following the cant of both sides on an issue about whether or not a housing development should be put in, on how one regarded coal-fired power plants and how one reported on coal, a fight over whether a coal-fired power plant should get a license. Those kinds of one-off set-tos between environmentalists on the one hand and an industry on the other hand are an important learning tool, but what's really kept me interested is trying to get beyond that into a broader look at how something happens. So not just one coal plant, but why the coal industry has, you know, continued to be so successful so long and how amazing it is that they're being gut-punched by natural gas. in a way much more powerfully than any environmental objection. So, yeah, learning new ways to create a sense of urgency is what keeps me going.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking earlier about some words that are bugaboos to you. I mean, and I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those. And I've put up on the screen a related story
yes.
that the students have read. So,
in fact, I mentioned that bugaboo in that story. Or I referred to it.
In the environment, I mean, in how we talk about the environment.
There, because it's the environment, environmental issues tend to be expressed in a binary way. Here's an evil, greedy capitalist industry trying to ruin a place, a body of water, the air, health, something that we think of as valuable in environmental terms, and here are the brave defenders of the environment. And that framing has been, I think, was extremely useful and not all unjustified in the early days of the environmental movement, but I think it's, even then there was a more nuanced look, and now there's a, you can have a much more nuanced look. And it drives me crazy when adjectives, which may have once had some meaning, are beaten to death in the service of this binary thing. So as I said in this blog post, it was a fight over an oyster farm, and the environmentalists defending it, their basic framework was, do you want a pristine, iconic wilderness, a pristine, iconic landscape to continue to have an industrial commercial enterprise in it? I haven't done this yet. You guys might have fun doing it. Google just pristine and environment and see what you come up with. I would bet it's almost always those two words are combined. Well, yeah, if you Google them, you know, with two, something very close together, are used as a way of expressing the importance of a place that somebody doesn't want something to happen to. Well, it could be, as it was recently, was pitched a story near Moab, Utah, where they said there's going to be the pristine, iconic environment of Arches National Park, that there's going to be oil drilling on the fringes of it, and then close to canyonlands. Well, I've done a fair amount of travel in Utah, and those are big spaces, and I looked at where the drilling was going to go, and it was right within a mile or so of the house of the person who was doing this, and it was at least 12 miles from the nearest border of Canyonlands, and it was 15 miles from Arches. I don't know about you guys, but 15, that's a long way. That really doesn't obscure the view, but that was, it was pristine and iconic. But what was pristine and iconic was the world she wanted to keep around her. And I don't know, did anybody do that? Did anybody find anything that's pristine and iconic in the environment? And it's almost always, I think, used as a sort of political weapon. Those words cease to have any meaning. In Drake's Bay, one of the things that is wilderness and therefore is pristine and untrammeled by man has, or I'm told, I actually have not completely confirmed this, has telephone and power lines that were undergrounded. So is it trammeled by man? Well, about 3 feet down, it's trammeled. You got all those lines down there, but not to my eyes. So it's a question of what does it actually mean to be pristine? Is it pristine and not touched by man if you just can't see the fact man touched it, but man sure did touch it? And that's my riff. You can keep going. You'll probably find words that both of those words once had meaning, but basically pristine means I think it looks really nice and what I think of as nature, and iconic means important, really important. And that's sort of not what those words used to mean.
So what's the difference between, so we have, and the students have looked at both the story that was in the paper and the blog post about a week.
Several blog posts, but a
blog post about a week later, you know, an epilogue.
Right,
to the story.
Right.
What's the difference between how you, what you write for the paper and what you write for the blog? Is there any? Or?
Oh, yeah. There is. In the first place, what you write for the paper is usually much shorter, although you can do a blog post after a really long takeout. The blog is, does about three things that used to be done when newspapers had more reporters and more room. One is there was something called a sidebar. Does anybody here know what a sidebar is? It's not a sidecar. It was a little article that went with the big article that sort of talked maybe about the big article included one person who was important, and you had a little profile of the person who was smaller. Or you did a little story about the town. Or it was some element, something that was in your notebook that was different, related to the main story, but different. Blog posts, some blog posts are just sidebars that have migrated to the web. Other blog posts are, call it reporter's notebook, a collection of things in there that never would have really made an article, but are in your notebook and would enhance the understanding or give a sense of your particular takeaway. And I'd say the stuff I did on Drake's Bay was a little more edgy. It was looking at the arguments that were being made in a critical way on both sides, but probably more critical of the side that deemed itself the environmental side. The reason I felt critical and could say more in a blog post than I could in an article is partly what seemed to be happening was that a political real estate decision about whether or not a national park should keep this commercial enterprise going when its lease ended in 2012 morphed because of what the Park Service and its environmental supporters did, morphed into a story about science. And they reported, and reported in the case of the Park Service scientists, and put a megaphone on that, those reports, in the case of the environmental groups, stuff that wasn't scientifically true. And I think as soon as you throw science out, or that was difficult to defend, either wasn't, some things just flat weren't true, as in, John wrote a paper saying that oysters destroy eelgrass and other living things. And John comes to me after I've put this in a Park Service document and put it out to the public. John comes to me and says, my paper said not a word about oysters destroying eelgrass and other living things. And I go, oops. Every single scientific communication that came out of the Park Service was geared towards the idea that the oyster farm was an environmental hazard. Well, there are lots of arguments you can make about oysters. These oysters, no, weren't native. That's a fair point. Oysters are filter feeders. They tend to clean up the body of water they're in. And as I said, you can argue it round and you can argue it square, but essentially it was being presented as a scientific fact that this was a bad environmental entity. All they had to do was say, we don't want you here, the lease is over. And that would have been a small story, there would have been a fight, but they had that option the whole time. Instead, science, the question was, and several studies really found, science was torqued to make their political point. I don't care what your political point is. Science and the scientific process in environmental reporting and environmental concerns are really all we've got. You know, we need the wildlife biologists. We need the atmospheric chemists and physicists, the climate scientists. We need a whole panoply of people, and we need to believe that the communications of what they are finding and what they're not finding and the limits of what they are finding, that's all of our responsibility, mine and yours in the future, to convey as accurately as possible. As soon as you use science, misuse it, misrepresent it, to advocate your side, even if your side is one of the most wonderful environmental goals in the world, I think you've done something extremely damaging because you've hurt the whole image of science if people call BS on you. And that was the sentiment that underlay some of there were three blog posts. There was part one, part two, and epilogue. And I was reporting on the science. In the end, that meant the folks at the oyster farm regarded me, I would say, were very cooperative with him. And some people on the other side, I got a lot of hostile comments in all the blog posts from people on the other side. I believe all those people thought I had a side in the fight. And I did. The side was science. The Oyster Farm was, to me, an occasion to look at the uses of science. I didn't really have a side as to whether it should stay.
I think in the case you're talking about, it's clear that the science was interpreted in a way or, like, changed to be political. But I think sometimes, I mean, in all science, there is a level of interpretation of the data. And so, I mean, even if you talk to scientists, like, you have to deal with, like, human bias or whatever. How do you try to take the truth or and deal with the scientific uncertainty and just, like, also, like, maybe ego about, like, the science?
Yeah, or rivalry, set positions, all the human dynamic of it. It's an excellent question, and again, for those of you who want to, you know, go forward in whatever way and communicate environmental issues, that is the key question. The science, you're not, with a few exceptions, I'm going to judge all of you, but in most cases you're probably not going to be competent scientifically to make your own judgments. I know I wasn't. Remember I talked about the learning curve? One of the earliest things I realized you had to have in a story was somebody who had the scientific knowledge, and nobody who's involved enough to have the scientific knowledge doesn't have a point of view, but to look for the person most able, with most open mind, who could say, well, I'm looking at the data, and I think the data argues that this fish stock is in danger of collapse in the next 2 years, and we'll never come back in our lifetimes if it collapses. But so-and-so at the University of British Columbia has looked at the same data. You should talk to him. He will think differently. What you need is people who you ask to be your surrogates. They have a really good knowledge, but they are your surrogates in that they have open minds. They may have opinions. And there you're better off with scientists or people who work closely with scientists than with advocacy groups, because it's in the advocacy group's interest to say this is what the data say, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So about half of the students are environmental science students.
Okay, so you're better than
I am. And so I wonder, what makes a good source for you? What is useful? What's a good source for you in a scientist? I mean, what makes a scientist who can really help you tell a good story, a good, accurate scientific story? What do you look for in a source who's a scientist?
Well, the first thing, and this gets to your point, is a scientist, for those of you who are headed more in the layman's communication direction rather than going to be scientists and communicating that way, actually for both of you, the scientist who doesn't think the journalist is a jerk who's going to oversimplify everything is the first thing you need. So you have to persuade the scientist that, yeah, you got limited space and you got no generalizations, and guess what? All the nuance that you have in your article ain't going to be in my article. But my article will express that there is nuance, will not do what you said and use the data without describing its limitations or that there are limitations. That's one. A scientist who trusts you to be true to the ambiguity and nuance of science. That's the first thing you need. The second is a source who will say, this is what I think, this is why I think it, here are the papers or the work that makes me think it, this is why I think, say, wolves in the Rockies, another huge issue, this is why I think their genetic diversity, the argument that they weren't recovered because the genetic diversity was not sufficient and that they were going to be inbreeding too fast. I think this data showed that. The judge thinks this data showed that, but there are other arguments that say, in fact, and this was a huge argument, wasn't enough genetic diversity, and that, you know, that's science with politics all around it. You want someone who says, here's the stuff that says you need X, Y amount of, you know, different genotypes in there for it to work, and here's somebody else who says the data showing that are really insufficient to make a large claim. And we said if you had Z breeding pairs, that was going to mean you had enough. And we've accomplished Z breeding pairs, and so you do have enough. In those arguments, I worry that... I worry that kind of science gets so politicized, you really do need to have a trusted scientist in there, a wildlife biologist, who can help you through arguments about sufficiency of different genomes. I'm using the language wrong, somebody help me, but you know, the extent to which there's genetic diversity.
But also, I mean, maybe somebody who will say, and here's some people who you should talk to who disagree with me.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a standard question.
Here's a good person who, you know, I disagree with this person, but he's all or she is also going to be fair about the argument.
Exactly. And when I'm looking for sources in a new subject area, I do say just that. I say, who's the most articulate person on the other side?
Oh, hi, I'm Olivia.
Hi, Olivia.
And I was just wondering, since, I don't know, I guess my view of environmental journalism has always been like, environmental journalist is always supposed to like kind of advocate a certain side. Like that's just kind of what I guess I've been taught in high school. But after reading your Oyster article, it really got me thinking. Like, since you showed so many different perspectives, and didn't really like specifically advocate a certain perspective.
As I said, my side was science.
So, well, I was just wondering if you think it's more valuable to society for a journalist to like take the role of more of a moderator of perspectives, or to be like a proponent of a specific. Like, what's the role of environmental journalists?
Excellent question. And let me just ask the same question back at you with one adjective change. What's the role of the religion correspondent?
Well, I
mean, Ezra, go ahead. Anybody else? I will answer your question. I don't mean to dismiss it now.
A little bit louder.
Sure. What's the role of a correspondent who covers religion? In context of her question. Are you supposed to say it's good to be religious?
To provide thorough but unbiased facts about all of this.
So if you're a religion correspondent and you find out about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, do you write about it?
Of course. It's,
okay.
It's the whole truth. It's something that deserves to be known.
And if you're a religious correspondent and there's a fight over gay marriage, do you, in covering it, do you advocate for gay marriage? No? So there may be different answers. I'm not saying there's a right answer.
You have someone who is for gay marriage talk about why they're for gay marriage, and someone who is for the Roman Catholic Church and why they don't support gay marriage talk about that. And
at a minimum.
In your article.
At a minimum, I think you... binary is not a concept I'm comfortable with, but that's it beats unitary.
The most articulate person on either side, and they would be able to like synthesize. I mean, you don't want to synthesize everybody's thoughts.
Yeah.
Because they can't, but finding someone who's somewhat articulate on either side and including that in your article.
Right. See, the thing about advocacy is, your question is what's kind of better for society, and I kind of think you need both. Now, whether you call it journalism, communications, or something else, that's definitional and dancing on the head of a pin. I don't think things change unless there's really eloquent advocacy with in-depth, you know, backed by in-depth knowledge. I don't call that journalism. Call me crazy, but that's, I don't object to that. And I do think you need... Here I'm really old school, and I don't know how much of this is going to survive till you guys are my age, but I do believe in the old media thing about, it's not so much objectivity, but it's what I described earlier. It's having an open mind, an empathy for a desire to understand how a point of view got there, why somebody could be doing, advocating something that you personally think of as so odd. The theory was you have that, you call it objectivity, you call it getting all sides, you call it lots of different things, and every one of the things you call it can be picked apart definitionally. But I say it's a state of mind, that the people who read my stuff can trust that I have at least examined, at minimum examined my own biases going in, and at a maximum done my best to get, as you said, every side, the nuances by which the sides came. If you got an hour to report a story, there's a limit to what you could do. But I think there's a frame of mind, and I think environment, in coverage of the environment, communications about the environment, would be much poorer if you didn't have a place to go where you might find an environmental reporter being critical of an environmental outcome.
And I would just say, that in addition to, I think, you know, a frame of mind and beliefs, it's a set of practices.
Yeah.
Of being fair to all sides of an argument, of, you know, representing them accurately mm-hmm. and fairly, of representing the kind of heart of their arguments and not picking at little
right,
things,
yeah.
you know, of being transparent about your sources so that your readers can trace your sources. And in many ways, they're the same values that we share within, you know, within research in the university, whether it's in science or the humanities or the social sciences. It's those same practices of, you know, of how you construct an argument in open.
And just one other thing very quickly, I'm sorry I talked too much. I recently was talking to a group at Yale and they had these teas. It's cool, I've never been to a master's tea before. So they have houses, the houses have teas, the houses have masters. So I'm there talking about something and somebody said, what are the three biggest, I gave a little speech about what I think are the three biggest issues right now, problems and three best things happen. And at the end of it, since one of my issues was climate change, the master of the house looked at me and said, I thought you were a journalist. I see you're an advocate. And I said, oh, how did that happen? And the question, he said, well, you know, there's some dispute on issues of climate change or something like that. And I thought a second and then said, well, I guess for purposes of this, I think questioning the basic conclusions that scientists have come to is like questioning the heliocentric, questioning the heliocentric universe, and I don't think that's adequate.
So I guess the something as politicized as environmental science, which definitely gets a lot of attention. How do you stay away from he said, she said journalism? How do you a scientist is definitely like a way to term that they can't answer every question about.
So I'm reintroduced. Be sure to introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I guess where do you find that? Where do you find that other angle? Where do you find that bigger picture? The implications, and sort of stay away from saying it's good.
How much time do you have as a journalist? How much time? Not how much time do you have here? How much time do you have to report the story?
If you guys do it in a week.
Okay. Then it's fine. I'm saying if you've got a day to turn it around,
then it's a lot of.
It's not, you still, if you've got a good stable of sources, you can make it better than he said, she said.
Okay.
If you've got an hour to turn it around for online publication, the president has just announced some action, all the environmental groups come in with their statements, all, you know, the oil industry and the timber industry, whoever comes in with their statements, you're doing, you know, it's very hard to avoid. The shorter the time, the harder it is to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
How do you avoid it when you have enough time? And that doesn't mean it's ever acceptable, but you want to get all points of view, you want to do all these things, and don't have the time to get really deep. One thing, even when you have a short period of time, is a good Rolodex. You know there's going to be somebody there who always gives you a thoughtful answer. They get quoted too much in the end, but that's one thing.
I guess also having, people that we talked about earlier, that you can trust who are going to help you see the complexities of an issue really quickly. And those are the kinds of people that you develop over time.
Yeah.
When you're covering a subject over time.
Yeah, and you can get to the heart of it. But that's the basic answer. The just keep asking questions and ask everybody you talk to who else they would talk to.
So I guess I should ask, because before we run out of time, and I want to ask you the questions that I am asking all of the guests and who come to our class, and also that the students will be answering. But first, I want to ask a question. I think you're uniquely qualified to answer, and a lot of people are asking, and I think that some of the students are probably asking too, is what's happening with environmental coverage at the New York Times?
Okay, well, the structure is changing, and the structure that is changing is 4 years old. Now, that's in some time horizons, 4 years is a very long time, and in some time horizons, 4 years is a very short time. You've probably, if you've thought about this issue, read Andy Revkin's .earth blog post on this. And I think basically the number of people covering the environment or reporting sense is going to change slightly. I don't know if the identities of those people will change, but it's not going to be much less. It's going to be somewhat less, and maybe some of the people who are currently doing it stop doing it and somebody else comes on. There will be people dedicated to covering the environment at the Times, we've been assured of that. So then the question is, well, what's the best way to cover the environment? I did it for, if your math is right, and I guess it is, for close to 6 years without an environment desk. I did it for a smaller number of years with an environment desk. Did I do more stories in one way than the other? Did I do better stories in one way than the other? What is good environmental coverage? Newspaper journalism and most journalism in the end gets down at its most basic to what the reporter sees and how much they're in sync with their editor and what their editor can do to help them broaden their vision or make it more interesting or everything or anything. The personality of the reporter and the personality of the editor are the single most important, kind of dynamic in the production of journalism. Other things are hugely important. Having an environment pod meant you not only had an editor who was interested in what you were working on, you also had an editor who knew everything that was happening, ideally on environmental coverage around the paper. That, to the extent that that's the utopia, and we've ceased to strive for that utopia, I think that's sad. To the extent that that's not necessarily utopia, and we continue to strive for the best environmental reporting possible, I think that's not so sad. So I'd say don't judge us now by the loss of this structure, even though it doesn't look terrific. Judge us by what the coverage looks like a year hence. How many stories Justin Gillis has done about our science correspondent. He's amazing. I have great admiration for him. How many stories have been done on national environmental issues? How creative the coverage is? How much it speaks to other sections, business, sports, whatever else? Structural issues, if this desk were arranged differently or you met more times a week for less time each or fewer times a week for more times each, does that mean there's less emphasis on the class? I don't know.
Well, I know the students and I would like to spend more time with you.
I'm too
And but we're coming too quickly to the end of our time, and I want to ask you a few questions that have a longer time frame than those 4 years. And those are some questions that we're asking of all of our guests and that the students are also answering. And the first one is, what does the Anthropocene mean to you?
Anthropocene, I'm probably cribbing pretty directly from Bill McKibben and The End of Nature. The Anthropocene means to me a period when our species dominates what happens to the natural world in a way, and in a way that is unique in the history of the Earth.
And how does the Anthropocene change how we should think about environmental communications?
That's harder. The fact of it being the Anthropocene, of man dominating things, means that our communications inevitably are going to directly or indirectly say, you, person reading this, are part of a species that's responsible for X, Y, or Z. Therefore, our communications are going to induce either a great sense of activism, because we're part of a, you know, we should respond to things, or a great sense of resentment. What do you mean, me? What did I do? I got up, I used some tinfoil, I forgot to recycle it, you know. Get off my case. Being, and there are plenty of other examples of, you know, if you believe biblically that man was given dominion over the earth, well, the Anthropocene is part of the plan. So I think what it means in terms of communicating is it increases the urgent need for getting information across that could change behavior in ways that will be beneficial to the natural systems that we have been, you know, that are here in our time, and we would like to continue functioning in future times. And it it means that there has to be a great deal of tact and forethought in how a communication will come across, so as what is produced is at a minimum concern and interest and understanding for you. Yeah, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, but for you it might mean activism as a result. I'm not going to say that for myself, but I think on the other side, to avoid creating a sense of resentment, irritation, a sense that one is being considered morally inferior for not getting this. Basically, I think it's an extremely delicate period in which communication is of critical importance, and the ease with which communication can go off the rails and its effect is very great.
And what about the changing media landscape? How is that changing how we should think about environmental communications? It sort of seems like at the end of that, as you're almost getting there too. I mean, that just in the changes in the media, there are also so many ways that things can go off the rails, but perhaps also so many different ways that the opportunities for communicating. We see that around the times. I mean, proliferation of blogs and other...
And video journalism.
Video journalism at the newspaper.
That's a whole class's answer.
Okay.
And I'm trying to do the really elevator answer for that. Everybody knows that the media landscape's fragmenting. Everybody knows that you guys are getting stuff, and I am now, from Twitter and Facebook and other things, and transmitting it in different ways. I think the main thing about the change in the media landscape, what you don't lose, no matter what the platform is the need for trust. So you guys are going to forward something that's a friend has put on their wall, a video, a cartoon, or whatever, because you share their sensibility, that's why you're friends, and you trust them, and you send it outward. I think that in any medium, Twitter followers, whatever else, yeah, there are lots of other things. Social cachet, you know, many things go into human interactions and what information gets passed on versus what doesn't. But trust in the solidity of the information, in the processes and values you talked about, I think transcends all platforms.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful, it's a wonderful note to end on also, because, I mean, you know, trust is something I think we work all of our lives and all of the different aspects of our lives to build up, to hold on to cherish and value, and it can be lost so easily. But I think it's an important thing for all of you to think about in the variety of media that you're working on, in the variety of of stories that you're working on, that trust is such an important part of communication.
And I'd also say it doesn't mean you, trust and being serious and open-minded and all of that doesn't mean you can't have fun. And if you can have fun and be trusted and get people's attention that way, God bless.
Well, thank you.